Accession number 19990, Reel 11.
Chief Technician Roper, Reel 11. You were saying that you wouldn't have minded spending a bit more time on the Beverly while you were at a Dishwater rather than being sent to Northolt. Did the Beverly have any particular distinctive characteristics as an aircraft from your point of view?
Well, the thing with the Beverly, everything was big. No job on it was simple. To do a small adjustment, you needed about 10 tonnes of equipment to get you to the height to do the adjustment and so on. And, of course, it was nice. At the time, there was one squadron at Dishforth, a 30 squadron, and the training unit, the OCU, and there were two squadrons down at Abingdon. And we all had to take a turn at doing the parachute dropping support for the army. And so every third month there was a detachment down to Abingdon of a Beverly or two Beverleys to do this, our share of the para dropping at Watchfield and places like that. And being single, you got perks that you could take your car with you. You just drove it into the back of the aircraft and then take your car down, or your motorcycle, or as many bicycles as you wanted, and so on. And you got a bit more freedom. You got to go out to Abingdon and to Oxford. And it was, for a single man, it was a change of scenery, a change of beer. But as I say, when you land a Beverly anywhere that hasn't seen one before, people's mouths in those days tended to open, you know, goodness gracious, because it is a big, big thing. But as I say, it could be a very awkward aircraft to work on. And having been designed as a short haul, heavy lift, it was now flying routes out to Cyprus and even to the Far East, which it was never intended to do.
What were the implications of that then? Did it have to have a did you have to modify it in any way for these longer hauls?
Well, no. I mean, the thing carried a lot of fuel anyway. When it had been designed, they hadn't got an engine suitable to fit to it. It had the most powerful power-to-weight ratio piston engine ever designed. Although there are more powerful engines, power by weight, the Centaurus was a fantastic engine, but really it should have had a Tyne or a larger turboprop sort of engine, but sadly it wasn't ready when they designed it. Later the Belfast came, and of course it was well engined, but no, the Beverly, piston engines were on the way out anyway, but it was slow, and anybody that's ever travelled in it, you know, it wasn't particularly comfortable. The boom seats, in the boom they had easy chairs, but the rest of it was a bit rough and ready.
What was life like at Dishforth compared to life at Nicosia, well, generally?
Dishforth, I've always liked stations that are rural stations that are not too near the local town. But Dishforth was quite good because it's positioned not far from Knaresborough, not far from Harrogate, not far from York, not far from Thirsk. And so there was always plenty of new scenery to see, and of course in those days we were all starting to get cars and be able to run them, because there had been petrol rationing during Suez, and there were a lot of large cars going very cheaply. People could buy sort of Austin Princesses and similar vehicles for a song because nobody wanted them. And we all had cars of some sort or another, and we'd in those days we'd go out to Thirsk or Harrogate or wherever, and it was quite enjoyable.
What was the workload like compared to Nicosia?
It could be quite heavy. You had to work when needed, and if it was a Saturday or a Sunday and there was the work there, you worked until it was done, then you were given a stand down to compensate you. And on most squadrons it works that way, that you can have a week with nothing to do and then a fortnight where you just don't sleep practically. I can remember working into the night at because of course these aircraft are scheduled to go flying, and where they're going to do a trip to quite often to say the Middle East, it's going to be away for 30 hours, and so everything has to be done that needs doing to make sure nothing comes up en route. Sort of, you never have spare aeroplanes. You've always got to get the one ready that's designated to that particular trip. And we used to work far into the night, and you'd get, if you were doing an engine change in the dark, you had sort of lights rigged up to work by. And we had at Dishforth in those days the Red Shield Club, which was the Salvation Army. And the major used to, when he'd finished with his sort of Red Shield Club at 10 o'clock or whenever it closed, he used to bring out all the tea and the coffee and the cakes and things that they had left. And he'd do a tour of the dispersals, dishing out tea and coffee and stuff to the troops. Which is one of the memories, you know, they always were there to help us.
It was, I mean, were you working harder at Nicosia or harder at Dishforth, do you think?
I think I was working harder at Nicosia, because, I mean, it was important that everything was prepared for the following day, and we were on shift work anyway.
And you were doing guards as well, weren't you, for some of the time?
Yes, guards. As an NCO, I didn't do as many as the ordinary airmen, but I was a sort of guard commander, whereas they were out for 4 hours and back in for eight or whatever, the way they worked it. Yeah.
What about the detachment at Abingdon? What happened when you went down there? Was it just routine maintenance and so on that you were doing?
Well, it was first line, which we got down there, checked the aircraft were all right. And each day, if the weather was suitable, the paras would come along, and away they'd go. We did some interesting ones with the, I think it was either the Marines or the Special Air Service, dropping frogmen into Chichester Harbour, and at night, and things like this. But most of the time you knew what the job was, and providing the aircraft behaved itself, we were just there, we'd do the trip, pack the aircraft up, refuel it for the following day, sort out any little problems, pack it in, and then go down into the local village or into Oxford for a look around, change of beer, you know.
Well, I mean, did you actually go out on flights when the aircraft went a sortie for a
You could do, but not many of it. I mean, a lot of us had done a lot of flying anyway, and it was no sort of experience anyway, you know, unless it was that it was going somewhere that you wanted to go to and you wanted to see. You'd get people that would like to take a trip, and the aircrew would fetch other pilots and things down that probably weren't used to Beverleys to take them flying, but I can't. One of the things that the ground crew used to get involved with was at Abingdon they had a barrage balloon that used to go up to do the
The first jumps
from. And a few sort of brave lads used to go up and take a jump out of the barrage balloon, and some of the aircrew often seemed to make their first jumps while they were at Abingdon from the balloon.
Were you ever tempted to parachute?
No, not me. No, no. It's never appealed to me.
I think also here from Dishforth you did a detachment to Norway.
Yes, it was... now then, I've forgotten the name of the exercise, but it was, I believe it to have been the first British exercise in Norway since the Second World War. And I was allotted to take a Beverly, which was in a heavy drop role. This meant that it had no doors on the back of it. It had roller conveyors, and it had what they called elephant's ears, which were the tubular bits that fit on the back so that they catch the ropes and lashings when a load goes out or when troops go out. The sort of ripcord pulling
thing,
they go around these things. But fortunately for me, my aircraft, which was designed for dropping light armoured vehicles and whatever from, the DZ was under so much water, and so this particular aircraft couldn't be used. And so I was able, once we got there, to send my aircraft away, and it used to go back to Abingdon for spares or whatever, and via Malta to pick up duty-free and bits and pieces from there. So
it's rather a long route round, isn't it, going from Abingdon to Norway via Malta?
Well, that's right, but I can remember them bringing in duty-free hooch, and I can remember I think it had been back to Abingdon, but I used to wave goodbye to it and not see it for 3 days, and once it had gone, I had nothing to do unless, of course, one of my friends had a bigger problem on his aircraft. But we were at a place called Vairns, not far from Trondheim. And this was supposed to be a Norwegian Air Force training station. And they had these, I think they're called Saab Sapphires. They're small, light aircraft. And I believe that the undercarriage, as soon as you lift off the ground, the undercarriage automatically folds itself up. There was something about this little aeroplane. But what amazed us was that the weather was so bad, and there are these Norwegian pilots training in weather that we probably would have said, no, it's not suitable for flying in. The idea of the exercise, there were Hastings involved and Beverleys. It went up to the Arctic Circle to a place called Bardufoss. And this, I think, was where they couldn't use my aircraft, that Bardufoss had this DZ that was underwater. But we found that the local people in Norway welcomed us with open arms, particularly the elderly people who'd had experience during the war. But the younger element were pro-German and not very respectful to us. I think treating us with suspicion, but it was such a nice clean country, and the food, although a lot of it was sort of raw fish and things, it was quite an experience, and we enjoyed it.
Were you living in Norwegian accommodation when you were there?
Yes. I seem to remember that they were sort of wooden huts, very warm, double sort of glazed, and I also seem to think that they had sort of either whale oil or something. The polish that was used to keep it weatherproof, I think, was either blubber or what have you. And I can remember an excellent Turkish bath arrangement, you know, the hot coals and stuff.
Saunas,
yeah, excellent. But and as I say, the food was good. Goat cheese and this sort of thing that we had.
How did you get on with the Norwegian servicemen?
Well, a lot of, as I remember it, we had a very smart warrant officer who spoke perfect English and looked like a sort of American style uniform. A very nice chap. He was the liaison officer, mainly, I think, because of his English. I think he'd worked with the RAF before, but most of the servicemen that I seem to recall were sort of in very poor uniforms. They were conscripts. And also, everybody used the same mess. From the CO downwards, they were all in the NAFI that we used, sort of thing. And I'm not sure that, don't they salute you? If the rank you're approaching is above yours, you salute them or something. I know there was something strange, but most of the people I came across seemed to be these conscripts, and they didn't have a lot to do with us.
Was that because they couldn't speak English?
I'm not sure. You see, I remember that in the club that they, the NAFI club, it actually had NAFI written above it, and all the ladies in there spoke English. But I think they were officers' wives, and anybody that spoke English had been recruited just for the period we were there to make us feel at home. But it was good. Mm.
You're saying that some of the younger people would seem to be pro-German or anti-English. How did they show that?
They sort of looked at servicemen with distaste. You know, you could see that they weren't sort of happy that we were there, which really was surprising, because I think Norway had quite a lot to thank the British services for at the end of the Second War. I'm not sure, but I would have thought that although this was our first exercise in Norway, that there must have been other joint Norwegian and British and American sort of exercises in the Arctic prior to this one. But
what was this, a joint exercise? Did the Norwegians take part in it as well as hosting you, or was it an RAF exercise based in Norway?
Well, I can't be sure, because nothing seemed to me, other than the fact that we were located in Vannes and we were flying north, which we never saw any of the exercise itself. It was up at Bardufoss, and I would imagine the Norwegians were involved, but not at our location.
So Vannes was the mounting base for the operation?
Well, when we flew over, we flew the troops in both Beverley's and Hastings. We flew, in our case, from Abingdon to Vannes, and there were vehicles and things involved. Now, when we got there, as far as I remember, the troops all disappeared wherever they went, and from our point of view, there didn't seem to be many of us other than RAF ground crews living on the camp, sort of thing. So I think the troops were flown north. I think they ended up at Bardufoss, and we were just the taxi drivers waiting to take them home when they were brought back.
What were the technical facilities like at Vannes?
I know that when we got there, all the aircraft had a lot of litter on board, because it had been a long flight, and everybody had been given one of the cardboard boxes with an apple, a pork pie and a sandwich in, and biscuits and things. And of course there was a lot of waste, and I remember that we got there and we managed to get we had one of our own one-ton trucks, and I was detailed to get the rubbish off the aircraft, because they were going to go back to pick up another load. And we filled this one-ton truck full of half-eaten apples and what have you. And when we went to this warrant officer that was our liaison, he said, "Oh no, there's nowhere to dispose of this. We don't have anything, incinerator or anything." And so we had a rather cocky air loadmaster who had always caused us a bit of a problem. So I picked his aircraft, and with shovels we filled it full of all this food, you see. And
wasn't that a bit cruel?
Yes. I mean, we could have put a bit in each, but we filled his up and left him the shovel. And I got the paperwork, and they need trim sheets, you see. But if the aircraft's empty, you don't need a trim sheet. So when they came back from wherever they'd been and they were preparing for takeoff, I said, oh, here's your trim sheet, you see. He said, oh, I don't need that. I said, oh. And he must have spent most of the flight back shoveling this rubbish into the North Sea on his way across. But this is the chap that he was on our flight going over, and we had on board a group captain from Abingdon, and I think his name was Group Captain Sowerby. And like you do, they gave Group Captain Sowerby a chance to have a clutch of this Beverly, you see. And so he got out of one of the rear seats in the upper cockpit, and his jacket, his best blue jacket, was over the back of the seat, and he was either in flying overalls or shirt sleeves flying the Beverly. And they wouldn't let you smoke on the Beverly unless you went onto the flight deck. And the reason for this was that if you went onto the flight deck for a smoke, you could then be passed further down the fuselage to pump oil from storage tanks to the engines, and it's done on a big sort of handle pump, and it's quite hard work when you're at altitude. So some of us had gone onto the flight deck for a smoke, and if you didn't go with the first wave, the engines would be oiled, so you'd be all right. You just got a smoke and that was it. So we waited and we went up there, and the air crew had had their boxes brought round of rations for the trip, and they'd eaten what they wanted. But one of the things they had were hard-boiled eggs. And what this air loadmaster was doing was feeding hard-boiled eggs into the atmosphere through an astrodome, which was actually a door in the roof, but it had a glass blister. And there was a varipistol slot, you see, and he'd taken that off, and he was and pushing a hard-boiled egg through there, and they sort of explode in the atmosphere, and he was amused by this. But then, when they'd got all the boxes... All right, now we'll wait. Yes, having amused himself with the boiled eggs, he then had to dispose of these boxes with the half-eaten apples in. And so he opened the large door which the Astrodome sat in, which was probably about 2.5 feet square, and pulled the door down and threw his boxes out. But as he did so, there was a big flash of blue as the group captain's coat, complete with his wallet and everything else, went out through the top of the aircraft. And he closed the dome and he said, how do you tell the group captain that you've just thrown his jacket into the North Sea? And presumably his wallet, the lot was in it, but this was this chap who spent his trip back to Abingdon shovelling all this stuff overboard. Just another little memory.
What about the things like the repair and maintenance facilities at Vans? Did you take all your own with you?
Yeah. Oh, yes. Yes. You don't envisage having to do too much. They've got what they call zip-up stands, which are these tubular things that sort of make up like a jigsaw puzzle, and you can get to things. But with any luck, other than the odd sort of plug change and stuff like that, you don't get a lot of heavy maintenance.
Did you have a chance to look at the Norwegian's own facilities there for repair and
maintenance? No.
How long did this exercise last?
I think it was approximately 10 days. It might have lasted longer for other people that had to sort of prepare it beforehand and recover afterwards. But for us, I think it was about 10 days.
Did you manage to get far into Norway?
No, we went to Hell and we went to Trondheim. And Trondheim, in those days, if the mayor was teetotal, so was everybody else. And the thing we noticed was that if you went sort of into, say, a public convenience out there, there was someone in the corner offering you a bottle of whiskey, and it was all sort of illegal. Although we fortunately had our own supply of duty-free from Malta, which the Norwegian officers and so on enjoyed the whiskey side of it, and the Trondheim brewery supplied us with beer for the troops. But in town, I think you could get to drink in hotels, but not there were no bars or anything. And a lot of the drink was, although it had alcoholic type names, it was non-alcoholic. Lagerol and things like this, and it was surprising how many of the people became tipsy on non-alcoholic lager, because I was on Audley I would be the Audley Corporal, because it's before I was promoted. And we went to close the bar in the Naffy because we thought there'd be trouble between the RAF and the Army contingent, who were both drinking away merrily. And the Naffy manager sort of said, no, it's all right. He said, non-alcoholic. So he said, you should have told him that before you served them, because they're getting pie-eyed on this stuff. And it was psychological.
Did you have any trouble?
No, not to speak of. There was one instance where somebody, I know I put them under close arrest, but I can't remember what it was for. It was an airman. And it was something quite serious. And I wasn't in the habit of charging people when I was in the service, but I've thrown one or two inside when I thought it warranted it. Yes.
How did Norfolk compare with Dishforth?
Oh dear, it's a sleepy little station on the Ryslip line, and it most of the people there appear to be sick, lame or lazy. They came to work in civilian clothing. They went to the hangar, and they had in the locker room, they had an airman's locker, took their overalls out of it. Hung in it was their best uniform and their working uniform, which they seldom wore because unless they had an interview or something. And to all intents and purposes, they seemed like civilians. I arrived there and nobody knew why I was there. And I was wandering around the camp, arriving, going to each section to be booked in and an arrival chit being filled out. And I bumped into a pilot who'd I known in Cyprus. And I said, hello, what are you doing here? He said, well, don't you know? So I said, no. He said, well, we're getting some VIP helicopters. And I'm sort of posted in to be one of the pilots. And so that sort of cleared up the mystery a while. And then I found out that the helicopters they were getting were ex-army helicopters. The army had these Sycamore Mark 11, and they were the forerunners of the Mark 14, which we'd had in Cyprus, but they were a lot different. The design of them was different. They had a nicer cabin with the leather armchairs and so on, but the
what about the mechanical side of it?
Well, similar, but a lot more restrictive than the undercarriage was a shorter stroke, which then gave you more problems with this ground resonance. Also, on this particular aircraft, you had stowages for balanced weights.
Morning.
Good morning. Yeah, I won't go on just yet, but. It was It wouldn't carry quite as much. It was more comfortable, but also it, because of the on the Mark 14, you had a couple of water tanks.